Chapter 21. Decay. After August 1969, writes Professor Hue, power in Saigon belonged to three generals, Nguyen Van Thieu as president, Tran Tien Kim as prime minister, and Cao Van Vien as chief of the joint staff. They kept their positions until the eve of South Vietnam's collapse. As was customary in Vietnam, according to Hue, power was administered by each man's wife. Mrs. Thieu dealt with the businessmen, especially those of Chinese origin, and had her shares in profits obtained from import, export, and international trade. Mrs. Kim fixed a price for new appointments for the posts of chief of province, chief of district, and chief of police services at the provincial and district levels. Mrs. Vien's domain was the army. Contractors working with the army could pass through her intermediary, and she had her tariff for a quick promotion in the army. With the consolidation of power by these three men came a resurgence of what CIA summary 0387/69, dated September 12, 1969, called influence by the widely hated Con Lao group of the Diem era. The CIA memo named as members of the neo-Con Lao cabal Foreign Minister Lam, as well as the Ministers of Information, Economy, Finance, and Legislative Liaison. The memo noted that Dong Van Big Ming had predicted that renewed Con Lao influence could lead to a tragic clash between Catholics and Buddhists, and, the memo noted, apprehension is likely to increase over reports that the new information minister, Thieu's cousin, Huang Duc Nha, has appointed some 20 cadre from the Nhan Sa Party, a neo-Con Lao group, to key subordinate positions. Indeed, political developments in 1969 mirrored those of 1955, when Ed Lansdale was told that Diem needed to have his own political party. Likewise, to strengthen Thieu's position, the CIA in 1969 financed the creation of the National Social Democratic Front, described by former CIA officer Frank Snepp as a pro-government coalition of political parties. And, just as in Diem's day, Snepp writes, the CIA lavished large sums of money on the Thieu government to be used in cowing and neutralizing its opposition. The opposition being those nationalist parties like the Dai Viets that had relations with the Buddhists. With the Americans chasing the VCI, these domestic groups became primary targets of the special branch and its stepchild, Phung Hoang. In particular, Thieu felt threatened by Tran Nhoc Chau, the popular nationalist whose persecution was said to symbolize the fratricidal nature of the Vietnam War. But in fact, Chau's persecution had less to do with regional differences than with rampant corruption, itself fueled by the CIA's bottomless black bag and irrational obsession with internal security at any cost. Chau's problems began in 1969 when he launched an anti-corruption campaign against Thieu, his old classmate from Fort Bragg. The gist of Chau's claim was that Nguyen Cao Tung, a wealthy pharmacist and former Con Lao from Hue, was using CIA funds to undermine the National Assembly. Chau's crusade was seen as a threat to GVN stability, and as a result, the CIA sent two case officers to offer him enough money to start his own political party in exchange for backing off. When Chau declined, Rod Landreth informed General Dong Van Quang that Chau was secretly in contact with his brother, Tran Nhoc Hien, a senior Cuc Nhien Cu officer in North Vietnam. Quang issued an arrest warrant for Chau, charging him with a capital crime of espionage. Hien was arrested, Chau went into hiding, and on orders from Washington, Ambassador Bunker ordered Chau's case officer, John Van, to break off contact. At that point, Van, in June 1969, summoned Frank Scotton from Taiwan and arranged for him and Chau to meet in a safe house in Xia Ding. The conversation, according to Scotton, went like this. I said to Chau, Sergeant Johnson is standing by near the Cambodian border with some of his special forces friends. They're dependable, and they'll help you get out. But it's now or never. Chau was very emotional that night in Xia Ding, Scotton continued. He said, to run now would be the same as admitting I'm a communist, and I'm not, so I will not run. And so Chau remained in hiding until captured in late 1969. Ironically, while Thieu was using Phoenix to repress his domestic opponents, his own cabinet was crawling with communist agents. But in order to perpetrate the myth of GVN stability, the CIA was reluctant to publicize this fact. Consequently, says renegade CIA officer Sam Adams, in May 1969, Station Chief Ted Shackley indicated on a visit to Washington his belief that the Viet Cong had only 200 agents in the South Vietnamese government. He spoke from ignorance. An in-depth research study going on at that time suggested the real number of such agents was more like 30,000. Although 30,000 sounds improbably high, the extent to which the GVN was infiltrated was revealed in a counterintelligence operation mounted by CIA officer Ralph McGehee in 1969. Begun in 1962, Operation Projectile relied on a penetration agent inside what the 1969 Phoenix end-of-year report called a COSVN-level intelligence net directed against the Office of the President of South Vietnam and other ministries of the GVN. The leader of the spy ring was Vu Nguyen Nha, President Thieu's friend and chief advisor on Catholic affairs. Nha, a Catholic, had resettled in South Vietnam during the 1954 Lansdale-inspired exodus from North Vietnam. The spy ring's highest-ranking member was Hoinh Van Trung, Thieu's special assistant for political affairs and director of the Central Intelligence School, a position that placed him at the top of the CIO. McGehee inherited Projectile in 1969 when, after 6 weeks as Xia Ding province officer in charge, he became the CIA's liaison to the special branch in Region 5. In this capacity, he explained, I supervised 6 other agency case officers working with specific elements of the special police in and around Saigon. The principal Vietnamese player in the drive against the Cuc Nhien Khu's strategic intelligence networks was Special Branch Chief Nguyen Mao. Born in Ninh Thuan province, where Thieu was born and reared, Mao was graduated from the Dalat Military Academy in 1954. In 1963, Diem appointed him sector commander and province chief of Tua Tien province and mayor of Hue, in which capacity he put down the Buddhist crisis leading up to the coup. In the reorganization after the coup, Mao was made a Montagnard Task Force commander with the ARVN 22nd Division, a job he held until 1967 when he was put in charge of Cong Tac 4. The following year, he was promoted to lieutenant colonel and made director of the special branch of the National Police. Soft-spoken and smart, Mao wanted nothing to do with Phoenix. In a letter to the author, he says his great concern in taking command of the special branch was the unjustified arrest, false accusation, and arbitrary detention. Those bad manipulations couldn't be stopped since the province chiefs, police chiefs, and other officials would do anything to make Phoenix score, which assured them job security and higher regard. They knew that Phoenix was under the supervision of an American ambassador and that President Nguyen Van Thieu always listened to this powerful personage. They kept the special branch in the provinces too busy with arrest in village, confession worksheet, and charge procedure at the Provincial Security Committee, while I wanted to direct the special branch into professional activities, organizational penetration gathering information relating to policies and campaign plans, spotting the key leaders for neutralization. But I did not argue with them. I felt so alone, I kept my mouth shut. Mouth shut, Mao concentrated on smashing the Cuc Nhien Khu's strategic intelligence networks within the GVN. When McGehee gathered enough evidence to convince Shackley to let him roll up Nha's net, Mao galvanized his forces and the special branch sprang into action. Mao's small secret police cadre prepared individual files on each person to be arrested, McGehee writes. Late one afternoon, he called a task force into his office, then cut them off from outside contact. He briefed each 3-man arrest team separately, then passed them copies of the file on their target individual. At midnight, the police fanned out through Saigon and pulled in the net. The operation was a smashing success. House searches turned up microfilm of secret documents, document copying cameras, one-time radio-op encoding and decoding pads, radios, secret ink, and other tools of the trade. The special branch also had the good fortune of arresting a visitor of one of the targets who turned out to be the head of a military intelligence net in the MSS. All in all, 50 people were arrested and 41 spies were tried and convicted. The group included businessmen, military officers, teachers, students, and 2 top-ranking Chiu Hoi officials. However, showing that the GVN was so riddled by enemy spies that they were able to operate under the nose of the president, McGehee laments, was not the kind of success that the CIA's top officials wanted to see. That reinforced his suspicion that the CIA was unwilling to admit either the strength of the enemy or the weakness of its ally. To McGehee, it was obvious that we were bolstering a hopelessly corrupt government that had neither the support nor respect of the Vietnamese people. Meanwhile, other CIA officers were reaching the same conclusion. When Frank Snepp arrived in Saigon in 1969, he was assigned the task of putting together background profiles on targets for assassination by plowing through documents and conducting interrogations at the National Interrogation Center. "I would put together a list and I would turn it over to Mr. Colby's people," Snepp says in The 10,000-Day War. He would feed this list out to the strike teams and they would go to work. And that is how you become a collaborator in the worst of the terrorist programs, in the most atrocious excesses of the U.S. government. Others became involved in other ways. Consider the case of Bart Osborne, a Phoenix critic who enlisted in the Army in October 1966, was trained at Fort Bragg and Fort Holabird, and was classified an intelligence area specialist. "My training was designed to prepare me as an agent handler and consisted of classes designed to teach recruitment and training of agents and management of agent networks," Osborne testified before Congress in 1973. He added that his training included a session concerning the termination of agents through various methods, including assassination. A corporal with no knowledge of Vietnamese language, history, or culture, Osborne arrived in Da Nang in September 1967 and was assigned to the 525th Military Intelligence Group. His area of operations was south of Da Nang, outside a Marine Air Base in Quang Nam Province. Having been assigned to the unilateral branch of the military intelligence team, whose activities were extra-legal, Osborne used an alias and, for plausible denial, was provided with false identification indicating he was a civilian employee with the CORDS refugee program. Osborne slipped into his military uniform when it was necessary for him to see military maps or documents. Osborne's team leader put him in touch with a principal agent who was running six sub-agents in a single cell. The sub-agents were political specialists, gathering positive intelligence on VC cadres. Eager to expand his network, Osborne hired as additional agents people whose names he got from the employment files of a local American construction company. He sent his intelligence reports to the 1st Marine Division, the 3rd Marine Amphibious Force, the 525th MiG, the American Division, and, unknown to him, the Da Nang Phoenix Coordinator. Osborne's association with Phoenix was cemented when, to his surprise, he was told that the 525th's intelligence contingency fund was empty and that he would henceforth be unable to pay his agents. At this point, Osborne had two principal agents, 40 sub-agents in five cells, and operating expenses averaging $500,000 per month, lack of which prompted him to check his list of users for new sources of revenue. Recalled Osborne, "I was able to ascertain that the Phoenix program was receiving and utilizing my information. I visited the Phoenix coordinator, a U.S. Army major, and talked to him about the information that was laterally disseminated to him. He told me that any information I gathered would be used in the context of the Phoenix program. In return, I was guaranteed financial remuneration for my agents, use of various safe houses for clandestine meetings, and access to Air America transportation." Osborne also obtained drugs, draft deferments for his agents through phony enrollment in the Civilian Irregular Defense Group program, and $15,000 quarterly for bribing the local police. The Phoenix coordinator also offered a bonus of 100,000 piastres for high-ranking VCI members. In this way, regular military personnel across South Vietnam became involved in Phoenix abuses. When asked to explain why Phoenix abuses occurred, Snepp says the program was jerry-built because of the CIA's concern that the VC had penetrated the special branch and military secret service. The more fragmentation, the better the security. They didn't want it central so it could be exploited. "Unfortunately," writes Snepp, "for lack of finite guidance, the Phoenix strike teams opted for a scattershot approach, picking up anyone who might be a suspect, and eventually, when the jails were packed to overflowing, they began simply taking the law, such as it was, into their own hands." Explanations for why Phoenix was open to abuse depend on a person's politics. Snepp, who harbors a grudge against the CIA, says his former employer jerry-rigged Phoenix for its own security. Others say Phoenix was handed to the military as a cover for CIA negotiations with the VCI in Da Nang and Saigon. From Phoenix Director John Mason's perspective, accommodation was the root cause of all Phoenix woes. In an August 19, 1969 New York Times article, Terrence Smith quotes Mason as saying, "Favoritism is a part of it. Sometimes family relationships are involved. We know very well that if one of our units picks up the district chief's brother-in-law, he's going to be released." For Nguyen Mao, Phoenix was subject to bad manipulations by officials seeking job security and high regard. Likewise, South Vietnamese nationalists pointed to corrupt officials as the evil inherent in Phoenix, as was made clear in June 1969 when legislators complained that the police used Phoenix to extort money from wealthy citizens and that VCI agents supplied names of loyal citizens to the police, getting around the Colby Failsafe cross-check system by reporting through several different agencies. In this way, innocent people found their names on the dreaded Phoenix blacklist. Mismanagement by design, ineptitude, accommodation, corruption, and double agents were reasons why Phoenix abuses occurred. However, the actual reporting of abuses fell to Third Force Vietnamese and non-career American military personnel. It is to this aspect of the Phoenix story that we now turn. One of the first people to criticize Phoenix publicly was Ed Murphy, a native of Staten Island, New York, who spent 9 months in a Catholic seminary before enlisting in the U.S. Army. Following his tour in Vietnam, Murphy, from June 1969 through January 1970, was stationed in Washington, D.C., doing background investigations and security checks for the 116th Military Intelligence Group. At the time, he was one of a growing number of Vietnam veterans, almost exclusively enlisted men, who were publicly demonstrating against the war. In October 1969, Ed Murphy was also one of the few Americans acquainted with Phoenix. Murphy's determination to make Phoenix a political issue in the United States began on October 15th, while he was participating in the March Against Death outside the Pentagon. There, he encountered colleagues from the 116th MiG. "I was being surveilled," he told me. "I know because the people doing it told me so. I've been reading about you," one of the officers said. Having fought for his country in defense of its liberties, Murphy was angry to find that military intelligence was being used against American citizens who were exercising their constitutional rights. To him, this represented the Phoenix mentality in the United States. Just how serious Murphy considered this threat is made clear by his definition of the program. Phoenix, he said, was a bounty hunting program, an attempt to eliminate the opposition, by which I mean the opposition to us, the Americans, getting what we wanted, which was to control the Vietnamese through our clients, the Diems, the Keys, the Tues. For Murphy, all other definitions of Phoenix are merely intellectual jargon. Murphy is a man of conscience, a former novitiate at a seminary in Baltimore, whose deep-seated patriotism prompted him to enlist, despite his compunctions about the morality of the Vietnam War. After basic training, Murphy was sent to Fort Holabird, where he was trained as a counterintelligence specialist, then to the Defense Language Institute in Texas for Vietnamese language training. From there, he was assigned to Fort Lewis. On the plane from Fort Lewis to Cam Ranh Bay, he recalled, "I was given an article to read. It was a study by the American Medical Association on interrogation methods used in the Soviet Union. It showed how to do things without laying a hand on a person, how you could torture a person just by having them stand there." That manual was his introduction to the doctrine of Contra Coup. Upon his arrival in Vietnam on May 12, 1968, Murphy was assigned to 4th Division Headquarters outside Pleiku City, where his understanding of counterinsurgency warfare rapidly evolved from theory to reality. There were 5 enlisted men in his counterintelligence team, each with a sector, each sector having 10 agents. Murphy's job was to conduct sabotage investigations and to run undercover agents, furnished by the MSS, who acted as day workers on the military base. Murphy also inherited agents 11 miles away in Pleiku City and acted as the 4th Division's liaison to the local Phoenix coordinator, a CIA contract officer named Ron, who was posing as a public safety advisor conducting currency investigations. Once a week, Murphy went to the local CIA compound, along with various civilian and military intelligence people in the vicinity, to submit to the Phoenix Committee the names of VCI suspects their agents had fingered. Surrounded by a concrete wall, its gate manned by a Mountain Guard Provincial Reconnaissance Unit, the embassy house was located in a remote corner of Pleiku. Inside the compound was a barbed wire cow cage for prisoners. The cage, according to Murphy, was too small for prisoners to stand up in. Murphy was not permitted in the pick, which sat on a hill and looked like a U-shaped school. As for the identity of the people his agent surveilled and targeted, Murphy said, I would never see a North Vietnamese or Viet Cong soldier. This is post-Tet, and those people are all dead. What we're talking about are civilian infrastructure people supporting the NVA and VC. It could be anybody. It could be somebody who works in a movie theater, somebody sweeping up. When asked what kind of information he needed before he could have a suspect arrested, Murphy answered, none, whatever you wanted. When asked what sort of criteria he used to classify VCI suspects, Murphy replied, nothing. One of my agents says somebody's a spy. If I had reason to believe that he was telling the truth, and if I wanted to bring somebody in for interrogation, I could do it. It was that easy. I had an agreement with the team leader that I could do anything I wanted. I even wore civilian clothes. My cover identity was as a construction worker with Pacific Architects and Engineers. Murphy called his agents hustlers, entrepreneurs making money off intelligence. After noting the difficulty of verifying information submitted by agents at Phoenix committee meetings, the lack of files and things like that, Murphy told how one suspect was raped and tortured simply because she refused to sleep with an agent. Phoenix, said Ed Murphy, was far worse than the things attributed to it. It was heinous, but no worse than the bombing, and I don't apologize, but it was a watershed for me. It focused things. I realized it wasn't just a war, but that based on the assumption that nothing is worse than communism, the government of Vietnam, backed by the U.S., felt justified in suppressing all opposition while extending its control throughout the country. That control, Murphy explained, served an economic, not an idealistic purpose. Phil Lapitosa, an employee at Pacific Architects and Engineers, told me about $2 million in material and cash being unaccounted for at PA&E, that goods being sold on the black market didn't come from the Vietnamese, but from the Americans. In order to get into military intelligence school, Murphy continued, I and the other candidates had to write an essay on the debate about the Vietnam War. And the thrust of my paper was, what we do in Vietnam will come back to us. It was a one-world thesis. Well, I go to Vietnam and I see the bullshit going down. Then I come back to the United States and see the exact same thing going on here. I'm at the 116th MI unit, and as you leave the room, they have 9 slots for pictures, 8 of them filled, Rennie Davis, Abby Hoffman, Ben Spock, Jerry Rubin. And I am being sent out to spot and identify these people. This is Phoenix. This is Phoenix, he repeated, then added for emphasis, this is Phoenix. In Nam, I had composite descriptions, Murphy acknowledged, but then I wasn't in a place where we had technology. It doesn't make any difference. The point is that it was used in Vietnam, it was used in the U.S., and it still is used in the United States. Thus, Murphy felt justified in taking tactics the military had taught him and using them against his former masters. To me, he explained, Phoenix was a lever to use to stop the war. You use what you got. I got Phoenix. I'm a former intelligence agent, fluent in Vietnamese, involved in Phoenix in the Central Highlands. That means I'm credible. I'm using it. Intent on making Phoenix a domestic political issue to be used to stop the war, Murphy joined 2 other Vietnam veterans, Bob Stem and Mike Ewell, in an effort to inform the public. At news conferences held simultaneously in New York, San Francisco, and Rome on April 14, 1970, the 3 veterans issued a joint press release, without naming names, laying out the facts about Phoenix. And even though the release was not widely reported, it did perpetuate the controversy that had begun in February when Phoenix was first examined by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. By then, Phoenix was nearly 3 years old. How the Senate hearings came to address Phoenix is unusual. It concerns Francis Reitmeier, a Seton Hall Divinity School dropout who was drafted and attended Officer Candidate School in late 1968. Along with 40 other Air Defense Artillery officers, Reitmeier was trained at Fort Holabird for duty as a Phoenix coordinator in Vietnam. He was appalled by the instruction he received from veteran Phoenix advisors. Loath to participate in what he considered a program that targeted civilians for assassination, Reitmeier approached American Civil Liberties Union lawyer William Zinman in November 1968. On behalf of Reitmeier, Zinman filed a petition for conscientious objector status in U.S. District Court on February 14, 1969, while the rest of Reitmeier's class was departing for Vietnam. In the petition, Reitmeier said that he was told that he could supervise and fund 18 mercenaries who would be explicitly directed by him to find, capture, and/or kill as many VCI as possible within a given area. The VCI were defined as any male or female of any age in a position of authority or influence in the village who were politically loyal or simply in agreement with the VC or their objectives. Reitmeier was told that he would be required to maintain a kill quota of 50 bodies per month, and that for him to locate VCI, resort to the most extreme forms of torture was necessary. As an example of what was expected of him, Reitmeier was told of one VCI suspect being killed by said mercenaries and thereafter decapitated and dismembered so that the eyes, head, ears, and other parts of the decedent's body were displayed on his front lawn as a warning and an inducement to other VC sympathizers to disclose their identity and turn themselves in to the advisor and the mercenaries. Reitmeier was told that Phoenix sought to accomplish through capture, intimidation, elimination, and assassination what the U.S., up to this time, was unable to accomplish through the use of military power. The Vietnamese were characterized in racist terms so that the cruelties perpetuated upon them might be more easily rationalized. Reitmeier was told that if captured, he would be tried for war crimes under precedents established by the Nuremberg trials as well as the Geneva Convention. On the basis of this account of his Phoenix instruction, Reitmeier was granted conscientious objector status on July 14, 1969. The Army filed an appeal, but for public relations purposes, withdrew it in October, just as the March Against Death was getting underway. Meanwhile, the ramifications of the case set in motion the series of events that brought Phoenix under congressional scrutiny. Reitmeier was satisfied with having escaped service in Phoenix and faded into obscurity. Zinman, however, like Murphy, saw Phoenix as a lever to be used to stop the war. He pressed a copy of the petition into the palm of a senator on the Foreign Relations Committee. While the committee prepared to hold hearings on Cords in February 1970, a staff aide to Senator William Fulbright leaked a copy of the petition to reporters Judy Coburn and Jeffrey Cowan. Their investigation resulted in an article titled, "Training for Terror, a Deliberate Policy?" Printed in the Village Voice in December 1969, the article brought the subject of Phoenix into open debate. The military responded to Coburn and Cowan's article and Reitmeier's wild allegations on the day they appeared in print. Colonel Marshall Falwell, commandant of Fort Holabird, suggested that some instructors might have told war stories, but he insisted that torture and assassination were not part of the school's curriculum. He did acknowledge that Fort Howard contained a mock Vietnamese village where Phoenix advisors planned and mounted an operation for seizure of the village, then rehearsed interrogating VCI suspects whom they identified from blacklists. Because the object of such proactive operations was uncovering the enemy's secret agents, this was called an offensive counterintelligence operation. Falwell's answers fell short of allaying congressional concerns, however, and 1 week later gasoline was poured on the smoldering controversy when George Gregory, an attorney representing one of seven soldiers charged with murdering a Vietnamese agent, discussed his investigation at the Atlanta Press Club. According to Gregory, Phoenix advisors were flocking to military lawyers in Saigon in the wake of the famous Green Beret murder case, in which seven American Army officers in the B-57 detachment were nearly put on trial for murdering one of their agents. Apparently, the Phoenix advisors were concerned that they were susceptible to similar charges. Here, it is important to note that the killing of enemy spies was a counterintelligence function, while the attack against the VCI was a positive intelligence function aimed at bureaucrats managing the insurgency's terror campaign. However, the termination with extreme prejudice of agents and the assassination of civilian members of the enemy's underground organization did overlap in cases in which penetration agents inside the VCI were found to be doubles, playing both sides of the fence. Dealing with such people was the prerogative of the CIA and its special unit. In any event, the results of the Green Beret murder case were the termination of B-57 and a blow to the morale of Phoenix advisors in the field, although their anxieties were relieved in September 1969 when, at the request of President Richard Nixon and DCI Richard Helms, charges against the soldiers were dropped by Army Secretary Resser. The agent's wife, who worked for the CIA, was awarded death benefits, and the case was closed. A Gallup poll showed 58% of all Americans disapproved of the war. On January 12, 1970, Newsweek ran a story called The Rise of Phoenix, in which the program was described as a highly secret and unconventional operation that counters VC terror with terror of its own. In response, ICE's Director of East Asian and Pacific Affairs, Dennis Doolin, professed that a counter-terror program of the kind Phoenix was alleged to be would subvert and be counterproductive to the basic purpose of pacification in reorienting the allegiance of all the South Vietnamese people toward support of the government of Vietnam. And rather than acknowledge Contra Coup as official policy, as legitimate conflict management, the war managers mounted a congressional information campaign. Leading the charge up Capitol Hill was Henry Kissinger, who, writes Irwin Knoll, is known to believe the program can play a crucial role in destroying the Viet Cong opposition during the period of American military withdrawal from South Vietnam. Emissaries from Kissinger's White House National Security Staff, Knoll says, have carried encouraging reports on Phoenix to Capitol Hill. As the Senate hearings approached, the battle lines were drawn. On one side were senators who, on faith, accepted Kissinger's explanation that Phoenix was part of an overall strategy to protect the retreating American army, hardly something a patriot could fault. These senators used the hearings to praise Phoenix as it was defined by William Colby and his entourage, which included John Vann, then Four Corps Depcords, Clayton McManaway, Hawthorne Mills, the Tuyen Duc Province Senior Advisor, a District Senior Advisor, a Mobile Advisory Team Advisor, and a member of the Quangnam Marine Combined Action Platoon. No Phoenix advisors were invited to testify, so presenting the other side of the argument were several senators armed with newspaper and magazine articles written by established reporters sent to Vietnam specifically to investigate Phoenix. Among the journalists were Robert Kaiser of the Washington Post and Peter Kahn from the Wall Street Journal. Portions of their articles portrayed Phoenix as a program employing assassination and counterterror. One article in particular, "The CIA's Hired Killers" by Georgianne Geyer, raised congressional eyebrows. Calling the PRU the best killers in Vietnam, she compared them to terrorists, with a qualification that our terror was different from their terror in that there was no real political organization, no political ideology behind our terror. Their boys did it for faith. Our boys did it for money. Apart from Geyer's failure to recognize the worship of mammon as religion, her allegation that the CIA hired killers to commit terror cast a dark cloud over the hearings, one that William Colby, despite his initial opposition to the program, was called on to dispel. Colby's testimony earned him the reputation as Phoenix's staunchest defender.